analysis of each of the parts in terms of ideas that are behind it.
Yeah, even if it's a bit boring to go over technology and terminology, I think it's important because many of the magical words that sound everywhere and that sound so well, so important, they're normally very simple concepts behind them. And also technology, since it is the tools that can be used in all this area, it's useful to know what you have at hand to use and how it works, no? So, turn this on. Okay, so to start with technology, we'll speak about graphics and software. Computer graphics have had a long history, although they have been really available quite recently, about the last 15, 20 years. But a lot of research has been going on behind this, and especially acceleration of the algorithms that draw things has been very important because of the real-time issue that we were talking about before. So, well, these are only names, ZBuffer, culling, and transparencies, but ZBuffer is the technique used to sort the depth at which polygons have to be painted. When you model an object, you model it with polygons, like faceted. Although it can be smoothed out with some algorithms, what you have behind these polygons in virtual reality. So you have to have an algorithm that sorts the polygons in depth and decides what has to be painted first and what has to be painted last, so that a polygon that is behind another one doesn't come in front of it. Culling is just the name given to that the technique used when you have a polygon, you have to decide whether you're seeing its front face or its back face. If you're seeing its back face, it's probably no good on drawing it because it's normally pointing away from you. So if it's pointing away from you, there's no point in painting it, and you discard it, and that's called culling. And transparency as well, it's when two polygons overlap and one is meant to be like translucent. You have to calculate the color of the polygon itself plus the color of the polygon on the back and fuse them. Like this, there are dozens of algorithms that help render the images, and all these are very critical in calculation, so they have to be very well optimized. This, if it is done by software, it's very slow, but if it is put into chips, into boards, and it's done by hardware, it's much faster. This is what has been evolving very rapidly lately, and what has allowed virtual reality, like VRML, arrive to your PCs and things like that. QuickTime VR, this is technology which is not real virtual reality, but it was called VR because you can sort of move in a supposed environment. What it really is, it is a movie, a QuickTime movie, which is extracted from a panoramic view like this one. This is a 360 image. This site here coincides with that side there if you would close it in a certain cylinder like that. So you put the viewer in the center, and with an algorithm that detects which way he wants to look at, this distorted image, which is done like with a very wide angle viewer, is inversely distorted. Only the fragment that the viewer should be viewing, like for example, a part in the center. If you would show him only that fragment, he would see it distorted and it would not look as though he were standing in front of it. So it has to be distorted in an inverse way so that it is, you recover back the original image, right, of the building. And I say it's not real VR because it's not a synthetic image. It's a digitized image. It's been extracted from our physical environment. And you cannot really look where you want or move where you want. You can look 360 degrees around you and a bit up and a bit down. But if you want to move forward and go, let's say, from the center to one of the spaces here, you would have to change the image and have it prepared. You would have had to do a panoramic view of the other point. And if you would want to advance through this environment, you would have to have panoramic views of every step you do. So it's not really a choice of the user where he wants to go and look. It's more a choice of the person that has done the whole thing. And VRML we have talked about already. Okay, position and orientation sensors. These are very important because primarily because when you are exploring a VR world, you want to control where you're looking at. Normally, the way this works is that you the cliche you have of virtual reality, which helps in this explanation, is putting on a head-mounted display and looking at the images. If you want to look to what would be theoretically in your to your right in the environment, you would move your head around to your right, and the computer should generate what the virtual environment looks like in your right. To do that, you have to put a sensor in your head that detects this change of orientation of your view. This has been done in many ways. The first way it was done was through ultrasound. A company called Ascension adopted this technology in its beginning. And it works with three emitters on your head. It's like if it were three small loudspeakers emitting ultrasound frequencies. And then there's a triangle on the table or on the wall, which are like three microphones that capture the sound emitted by the three loudspeakers, small loudspeakers on your head. With this geometry configuration, it is possible to calculate the orientation that the emitters are adopting, and by the attenuation of the strength of the sound that is being emitted by the small loudspeakers, it can also be detected the position of the sensor. So this works quite well, but the problem is that there are many sound interferences. Like if you make your keys, if you make noise with your keys, there are some ultrasound frequencies generated, and it can disrupt the system, and it's the computer doesn't really know where you're looking, and it starts vibrating the image, so you get giddy. So there's a more robust way of doing it, which is through magnetic field. This is also done with a sensor on your head, or it can be placed on your hand or whatever, which detects a magnetic field emitted by a small box that you can put, for example, on the table. This generates a magnetic field on parallel planes like this, and the sensor on your head has three coils perpendicular to each other, which, when they are moved in the magnetic field, currents are induced in the coils, I'm doing some physics class now. You can also calculate know the orientation of the position and the position of the sensor in the field. Polymos, this company started these sensors, and the Ascension afterwards changed from ultrasound to magnetic field because Polymos was winning the sales competition in the field. This is a bit, well, it has problem with metallic interferences, so if you have a metal close by, you can have problems, but it's more robust than the ultrasound system. We can see the video now to see how this works. We'll see it in what is called motion capture. I'll explain later what motion capture is. Well, after the video,
first you see. Ascension Technology Corporation manufactures real-time motion capture equipment for the trademark Rock.
Rock
of Bird employs a patented pulse DC magnetic field sensing technology to capture the actual movement of one or more performers. Free to move about its transmitter. Because of its speed, range, and relative immunity to metallic distortion, the Flock is the leading choice of animators worldwide for capturing human motion. As shown here, the Flock is made up of a transmitter and one or more electronics units and receivers. For motion capture, up to 29 receivers are mounted on a performer. Upon power-up, the electronics unit controls the emittance of magnetic fields by the transmitter, which induces measurable changes in the receivers, whose position and orientation data are sent to a host computer over 100 times per second. Now we'll show you how easy motion capture works for performance animation. The heart of the Flock is its transmitter that emits the magnetic signals, much like the Earth's own magnetic field. The receivers, mounted at key joints on the performer's body, receives the signals and relays them through wires to the Flock's electronics units, one of which is shown in the foreground. It is the electronics units that compute the instantaneous position and orientation of each receiver by tracking their location in the magnetic field. Computer software then maps the realistic, subtle human motions onto corresponding anatomical points of the animated figure. The process occurs so quickly that a director and performer can see real-time feedback of a scene's content.
Okay. It's a very funny commercial video. And, well, the thing I wanted to show you is where the girl with the sensors on is moving, and you can see that figure in the background, which is following the movements. You can map the movement of anything, of any part of the body, onto any object. It doesn't have to be like that, analogy with the body. It can be just moving anything. Here, they're speaking about motion capture more than virtual reality because now it is very much used in filmmaking that characters, artificial characters, which have to do something mixed with real characters in films, if they had to be animated like in stop motion, even though it's graphics, it is very difficult to do, let's say, natural movements. That's why up until now, when you would see a computer-generated character in a film, it would look very robot-like, very very rigid. Now, with this system, the movement is captured in real time, although those parameters of movement, once the director has accepted them as good, they are saved, and then the image of the artificial character is generated frame by frame, very slowly, because it has to have many calculations to match the textures and things like that. It cannot be done real time. It's not virtual reality then. It's like as if we wanted to move the dinosaurs of Spielberg instead of step by step, a person doing the movements and then saving those movements and rendering each position of the dinosaur, right? But that has been an application that has come after the invention of the sensors for virtual reality. And when the man said that the magnetic field emitted by the box on the table was very much like the magnetic field of the Earth, it is in fact like the magnetic field of the Earth. And sometimes there could be interferences. The only thing is that this magnetic field that is emitted is much stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. But on simple systems, on simple sensor systems, there are sensors that are really working with the Earth's magnetic field as if they were a compass. So for orientation, they use this compass-like system, and they don't have to have a system that emits a magnetic field, which is very expensive. And for the other movements of the head, the roll and the pitch, that's yaw. The yaw is calculated with the Earth's magnetic field, and this is calculated with this other system of sensors, which is mercury sensors, which is like a very small tube with mercury in it, and there's some wires in it that can calculate how much mercury is spilled on one side or on the other, and it can detect whether you're moving your head on one side or the other. Okay, we come now on to one of the most polemic parts of virtual reality, what is called immersion, visualization and immersion. Immersion is the sense, well, normally the people define it as the sense of being there, as the sense of being in the virtual environment. Of course, that's completely related to this notion, this strange notion of reality, of our reality, no? But, well, for our concern, immersion is more the sense of being, of forgetting about our physical surroundings and being more attracted by the virtual environment. So it is a polemic issue because many people say that it is not virtual reality if it is not fully immersive. People say that if you are not using a head-mounted display to feel inside the environment, then it is not virtual reality. For us, this is completely wrong. For us, virtual reality is what I said before in our definition, which didn't speak about immersion at all. And there are many different levels of immersion which are valid for VR applications, and which we think that using a head-mounted display in some applications is not at all justified, and it's only like overdoing the thing and using too much technology for something that can be kept much more simple. So we start at the top with desktop VR, and we go down in an ascending level of immersion, which doesn't mean, as I said before, that it gets better. There's no better or worse here, so it's only different systems. Desktop VR is what you will be doing, having the computer on the desktop, on your table, and working with the screen. That can be quite immersive sometimes, because if you are very much attracted and you are close to the screen, you can really forget about your surroundings. So the immersion is also a very psychological aspect. Then there's the cyberscope, which allows you to see in 3D. We'll see each of these in turn. The 3D desktop VR, responsive workbench, and multiple VR in a room, they are more or less in the same level of immersion. Then comes the Mandala, which is a system invented, developed by a Canadian group, which is very similar to what Myron Kruger was doing. And then comes the head-mounted display, the boom, the cave, and the Eve. We'll see first the cyberscope. This thing, what it has is that the computer projects the right and left image of what you're seeing to produce a stereo view. As you know, we have a different view from each eye, but it's slightly different. It's not always useful to have stereo in VR, because our stereo view stops at about 30 meters from us, because the view of the two eyes is so similar from 30 meters onwards that the feeling of depth is not produced. The sensation of depth is not produced. Stereo view works from very close by up until a as I say, 20, 30 meters. So what it is that when the eye sees a different view, each one, the brain fuses them into one single image, and then we have this, as I said, the sensation of depth. So here, to do this, to generate the two images, the computer generates them sideways, like instead of like this, rotated sideways on the screen. And this apparatus, the cyberscope, through mirrors and lenses, turns them and shows, makes your right eye see only the right image and your left eye see only the left image. And so you have a feeling of depth in the environment. It's almost desktop, but you have the added depth cue. This is also to give 3D depth on desktop environments, on desktop systems. These are the crystal eyes, which are crystal liquid crystal shutter glasses. And what they are, it's as if they were two liquid crystal screens, like on the digital watches. Those are liquid crystal screens. And these screens can turn completely black, opaque, or completely transparent. And they do it alternatively, when the right is opaque, the left is transparent, and vice versa. And they do this 120 times per second. So you don't notice any blinking. If you are looking at your surrounding, you see as if you were not wearing anything. And this alternation of a black and transparent is synchronized with the images on the screen of the computer. When the right screen on the glasses is transparent, the computer shows the right image, the image for the right eye. And when it changes, the computer changes the image to the left. So you see, if it is as if the computer was showing the both images at the same time, because it goes so fast that it's as if you were seeing left and right at the same time. So your brain can fuse them and see the depth cue. This is the responsive workbench. This uses also the crystallized glasses, the liquid crystal shutter glasses. But the difference is that instead of looking at a computer screen, you have like a workbench, like a very large table, which is a screen where the images are projected. So this is very useful, for example, for architectural applications like this one shown here, where architects can have a model of the buildings they want to study and to see if they're going to work. And they can see them like sticking out of the screen, like in 3D, thanks to the shutter glasses. The thing is that if you want to change the point of view, the computer has to follow the point of view of one of the users. But it can only follow the point of view of one of the users. So only one can command and interact with the computer environment, and the others have only a passive view. They can see the 3D, but they cannot do anything. And the problem is that since nobody can stand in the same place as the people that as the person that commands, they have some slight errors in the stereo view and on the point, the perspective they are seeing. So they have to stick all very close together. It's a bit of a problem, but it's a very useful tool. Then comes the... No, this has skipped one thing. Then comes the head-mounted displays, which you must have different characteristics in mind when you want to use them, because everyone designs them in many different ways. The view angle is very important. Some have very narrow view angles, so you see the image as if it were floating in front, instead of having the image surround you and feeling more immersed. So using a head-mounted display, it's not even a guarantee of immersion. What is useful is that with the other systems that we've seen before, when you turn your head around, you lose contact of the view of the environment. If you turn your head around when you're in desktop computer or with the stereo view or the cyberscope or with the shutter glasses, if you see to your side, you don't see the right side of the environment or whatever. You have to control it always with a joystick or whatever. Here, if you move your head, you're still seeing the environment because the head-mounted displays, they are screens that are in front of your eyes, one for the left, right eye and one for the left eye, so that you can fuse them. And if you put a sensor in your head, when you turn your head around, the computer can calculate the images you would see to your right, and you are still viewing the environment. So characteristics like view angle are important. The resolution and definition of the screens is very important. Some, when the head-mounted displays were first built, they were very coarse, and very big pixels on the screens, and so the image wasn't very smooth. Then some head-mounted displays are not even stereo. They will show you the same image on both sides, so you don't have a depth cue. And there are even ones that only have one screen, but these are very few. Distortion is very important because if you would only put the screens in front of your eyes, you would see very, very small images floating in front of you. So to make them larger and more surrounding, you have to put like wide-angle lenses in front, and this distorts the image a little bit. So sometimes you have to calculate inversely distorted images so that when you see them through those lenses, you don't see them distorted. Also, adjustments of the head mount is very important because we are not all the same. We don't all have the same the possibility of seeing without glasses. We don't all have the same distance between eyes and other adjustments, which are very important to calibrate them well so that you don't have eye strain after wearing the head mount. Weight and balance is also very important. Old head mounts were very heavy in the front, and you would like have like a brick stuck to your face, and you would like sort of fall forwards. And if you would put a counterweight on the back, then it would be so heavy that you would have strain on your neck, and you would, at the end, you would end up like this. No? So head mounts tend to get lighter and lighter with every new generation. Robustness is important if you are using it in a very large place where lots of people are going to be coming in and out and trying it, because they are delicate apparatus and they can get broken easily. And ease of use also is important in this case, because if it's very difficult to put on and put out, you can have a very small amount of people going through per hour. So the type of screens that are used have varied very much. As you saw, Ivan Sutherland used CRTs, that is like small television screens like that, but they are very heavy and they use very high voltage to generate the image. So it's like sort of dangerous having this high voltage next to your brain. It creates magnetic fields and things like that. So you have to be careful. So what head-mounted displays started working with was LCD screen, liquid crystal screens in color normally. But they have a very low resolution, or they used to have very low resolution, so the image quality was not very good. VPL iPhone, which was the first head-mounted display which was commercialized, used passive color LCDs. By passive, it means that they don't emit light by themselves. You have to reflect light on them. And if you would move the head mount up and down or sideways, you would lose contrast. So it was very difficult to have a very good adjustment of the H&D. Now, most H&Ds use active color LCDs, which means that they emit light themselves and they have good contrast. The head mount at the top is the first head mount used in games. It's the Nintendo Virtual Boy, but it's a very silly head mount because it's a table-based head mount. You put it on the table and you just stick your head on it. So there's not much difference between this and having the screen. It's just only to sell more games. And the most strange thing is that it is monochrome, but in red. It's red and black images. So it's really lousy thing. The ones at the top is the one, at the bottom is the ones we're using where we work. It's the virtual IO eyeglasses. As you see, it's now a very compact head-mounted display. It only has a problem that it has a bit of a narrow field of view, but it's very light, very robust, and very easy to use. CRTs have been every time more and more perfectioned, and are now being used much more because they are lighter, they use less voltage, and even though they were monochrome in the beginning, someone decided to use a very clever system to see in color. The screens show you first the parts of the parts of the image that should be in red. Then immediately after, it shows you the images that the part of the image that should be in green, and then the part of the image that should be in blue. That shows it in black and white, but in every time a red filter, then a green filter, and then a blue filter comes in front of the screen, rotating, so that when your retina captures it, it sees red, green, blue, and you know that red, green, and blue light combined in different proportions makes colors, all possible colors. So you can see color images with this system, which goes very, very quickly, and you don't see any blinking or any strange effect, and you see color images with monochrome CRTs. Then there's another interesting technology, which are silicon mirrors, which is a very new technology developed by Texas Instruments. They are on a silicon chip. You have microscopic mirrors which basculate in two positions. If they are in one position, the light that is reflected on the mirror goes into your retina, and if it's basculated on the other position, light is thrown out from your retina. So there you have black and white. And with the color filter systems, you can have color images. So this is very good because it has much better resolution than CRTs. It's way much lighter than CRTs, and it doesn't use high voltages. So it's going to be like the future technology of head-mounted displays, although it's only now in laboratory experiments. And finally, what is said that will be the technology of the future in head-mounted displays is laser. Laser images being projected directly on your retina. The problem up until now was that you could only have monochrome, either red or green lasers at normal temperature. Blue laser was not obtained until very recently, but it can only be obtained at very, very low temperatures. You can only work with a laser generator at about, I think it's minus 200 degrees Celsius. So it was not possible to combine them with the red and green to generate color. But now it seems like white laser can be obtained at very normal temperatures, and so you again have black and white images, and with the three colored filters alternating, you can have again color images. And the resolution of this technology will be very soon the same as the resolution of our retina, so it will give very clear and smooth images. And that's a prototype that is already working in one university of this new laser technology. Okay, this is the mandala system, which I said before was very similar to Myron Kruger's system. On the top you can see the system. It's a booth that has blue background to use chroma key as in television, you know, when the presenter, the TV presenter is behind a blue screen, I mean in front of a blue screen, and then with some systems they can put another image behind him because they substitute all that is blue with this image. That's why they cannot wear blue, because they would look transparent. So this is the same system. They use chroma key to capture the image of the man. The image captured by a video camera is fed onto a computer, and then that image is processed in a way. So at the bottom you can see the man that is traveling on a sort of a rocket, and he's been immersed in a game where he has to destroy helicopters and other things, and that's why he's doing strange movements, because he has to bang the helicopters to destroy them. Well, this is only a game application, but it's an interesting system to have in mind also, and to do interesting things. It's also a 2D system only. This is the boom, which is not a head-mounted display, strictly speaking, because it is mounted on an arm, sort of like the thing that Ivan Sutherland used, but this one is much more flexible. It can have lots of freedom of movement. And it is very good because what is in the screens, they are CRTs, so they have very good image quality. And it's not dangerous because you don't have to have the magnetic fields next to your head. They are just in front. And since the arm holds the weight, it doesn't mind. It doesn't matter if it's very heavy. So we can see a video about this.
Physicists from the National Center for Supercomputing Applications study the birth of the universe and the formation of the galaxy. NASA Ames Research Center has pioneered virtual reality research and applications in flow field visualization for nearly a decade. Here, the operator is using the boom to look into and steer the real-time supercomputer simulation of particle traces. NASA.
Okay, this is the cave, and this is a very different concept from what we've seen up until now. Although, well, it's a bit similar to the responsive workbench, but this is much more immersive. This is a room, as you can see in the picture. You will see a very nice video of it now, but I'll explain it briefly. It's a room where you have three screens, one in front, two at the side, and also the floor is a screen where the images of the virtual environments are projected. And you're wearing the crystallized shutter glasses to have the 3D cue. And you can interact very well with the environment because it's very immersive, and you feel inside it because you are physically inside it. This is also very important development, which was developed at the University of Illinois also, just as the first data glove was, by a woman called Carolina Cruzneira, whose family comes from Galicia, but she's American. And the good thing about this is that many people can be inside, and many people can talk about what they are seeing, and it's very good for designers. It is used very much in General Motors company to design cars, and in NASA to design airplanes and rockets, and in many different applications. We can see. Oh no, wait. We have to change.
Thank you.
The CAVE Virtual Reality Theater is a projection-based system. The illusion of immersion is created by projecting stereoscopic computer graphics into a 10-foot cube made of screens that completely surround the viewer. Viewers explore virtual environments by walking in a CAVE space. Head and hand tracking systems produce the correct perspective projection from the user's point of view and determine the position and orientation of a handheld device we call the wand. This device is used for control and interaction with the virtual world. An audio system is also used and provides sound feedback. The current implementation of the CAVE has four screens, three surrounding walls, and a floor. Each side of the cube has an associated electrohome projector and a Crimson Reality Engine workstation from Silicon Graphics. Mirrors are used to fold the optics to reduce the space required between the projectors and screens. Stereographics LCD shutter glasses provide stereo viewing. The tracking systems are a Polemis IsoTrack and Ascension Technologies Flock of Birds. The audio system includes a sampler with a MIDI interface and six speakers. The entire CAVE system is controlled by a Silicon Graphics personal iris. The CAVE is a non-intrusive interface where reality and virtual reality are combined naturally. Wearing lightweight LCD shutter glasses, users can see themselves and their real surroundings blended with the virtual environment. Interaction with the virtual environment is done with the wand. Its controls and functions depend on the needs of each particular application. In this application, we can see how it is used as a navigation device. In this one, the wand maps the user's head with the computer-generated head. As the user slices his head with the wand, he can see the different sections of the internal structure. Another use for the wand is the ability to pick and move virtual objects. Audio feedback is used to complement the illusion of immersion. Visuals and audio are choreographed to respond to the user's actions or to reflect the state of the virtual environment. Multiple users can easily share the virtual experience by putting on a set of stereo glasses and stepping into the CAVE. In the current implementation, one user actively controls the viewpoint by wearing the tracking glasses. Other users passively perceive the experience, much like watching a 3D movie. Since the CAVE gear is so easy to wear, users frequently exchange the tracking glasses during the experience. This shared experience also allows for guided tours by an expert navigator. The CAVE is a general virtual reality interface. Its design is flexible enough to be used in a variety of applications. Most applications shown in this tape are collaborations between the Electronic Visualization Laboratory and invited researchers from various disciplines. The CAVE is an effective visualization tool which provides scientists a new way to explore their research data.
As you see, Thomas DeFanti and Dan Sandin were the directors of this PhD project, which developed the CAVE. And if you remember, Thomas DeFanti and Dan Sandin were the first to develop the data glove and to found VPL research. Oops. Put it back. Okay. So they're also the part of the invention of the CAVE. The EVE is another system developed by Jeffrey Shaw. He is an Australian artist, and he is now the director of the media department of the ZKM in Karlsruhe, Germany. The ZKM is the Zentrum für Kunst und Medientechnologie, Center for Art and Media Technology. And he designed this system, which is sort of a moving window with which you can explore the environment. The system works with this sort of a globe, this sort of balloon, inflated very large sphere, which all the inside is a projection screen. In the center, you get a robot arm, which holds two projectors to project stereoscopic images. The users wear crystal eye glasses to see the depth cue, And there's one person that controls the point of view with also a sensor in their head. When he moves his head around, he moves this projection window that you can see here to the place in the inside the sphere that he's looking at. But he doesn't move that image with the window, but only the window. So it's as if he were surrounded by the environment, and he was looking through a piece of cardboard and looking at the different places, right? So he is like developing, like photographically developing the whole environment around him through a small window, and the rest of the people can follow it by just looking at at the place where the window is. Sound technology is also linked to immersion. You can have normal speaker sound or normal headphone sounds, but normally what is known as immersion, sound immersion in virtual reality is a 3D either speaker or headphone sound. What this means is that if you hear a sound in virtual reality, especially in a simulation of our physical environment, you will want the sounds to be heard as if they were coming from the direction where the emitter of that sound has produced the sound. As if, like when he has coughed, I didn't hear like the cough only anywhere in space, I heard it clearly coming from there. And if you're simulating environments, it is important that the user has a clear notion of where the sounds are.